when tape recorders first came out in northeast Thailand, where Ajahn Chah was, he was so enamored of his own voice that these tape recorders would be, I wasn't there, Ajahn Sarita tells me. I think he had him on a PA system, he'd just be listening to his own talk. Just during a meal. Ajahn Chah used to smoke. Probably heard that. And then a lot of the monks smoked, apparently. And then he thought lay people were buying luxury items for the monks, so he forbade smoking. It wasn't about lungs. That was probably pre-lungs. People didn't understand that. But when he came to visit us in... he came to England twice in 77 and 79. And in both times, I think, we had our first anagarika, Jerry Rollison. And he was a very, very intense artist. He did a very famous portrait of Ajahn Chah, which is a beautiful piece of work. But Jerry was a smoker, did his own roll-ups. And if I have it correctly, I think he got into a severe argument with one of the anagarikas in the kitchen. We were living in London. I think Ajahn Sumedho, and he was trying to give up smoking. And he got so difficult when he gave up smoking, Ajahn Sumedho forbade him to give up smoking. but anyway, so then Lompa Cha used to smoke. And we lived in the Hampstead Vihara, which is on the edge of Camden Town in Hampstead, on a very busy road called Haverstock Hill, I think. And so it was this kind of narrow Edwardian four-story building and a long, long yard in the back. And there was a bench there, and I think Jerry was doing his roll-ups, and Ajahn Chah came up to him and nodded to him. So then Jerry rolled two for him. And it was really lovely to be sitting on the bench together. Like in Thailand, you'd never sit on a bench with a senior monk like that. You'd always be lower. But there they were, two mates smoking cigarettes. And I'd never seen Jerry so relaxed. And Ajahn Chah had this kind of gift of figuring out where a person was at and giving himself to that person in a way which was both loving but also directed. And it was really lovely kind of to see that. And he was a very elegant smoker too. So today I was just thinking about like culture, and because yesterday I got a bit overwhelmed with the jokes about the radiant beings. So I thought, the person who probably wrote that might have felt awful. So my apologies if I offended. I'm quite a benign fellow, but sometimes I can go for it with the absurd. But I was just kind of thinking about like culture and how. You hear, a famous master smoking cigarettes. Shocking, right? Because now culturally, to smoke a cigarette, it's like you're a leper. It used to be cool and suave. Now you must be a complete idiot if you smoke a cigarette. This kind of cultural perceptions that we have. That's, I think, a very interesting one, how we used to perceive smoking and now how we perceive it. And so one of the... In the teachings, they have this teaching on the three fetters, and they are the ways of viewing the world which prevent what we call stream entry. And stream entry is the idea that one is into the flow of Dharma rather than into the flow of reactivity to the khandhas. That's kind of Buddhist way of putting it. And one of them is personality view, where we grasp things in a very personal way and get caught up in that way. One is doubt, where we're always caught in doubtful states of mind, thinking, intellectualizing. And the third is silabhata paramasa, which is translated usually as belief in rites and rituals. And Ajahn Sumedho has really helped me with that one, where he's expanded it to say, well, it's your cultural conditioning that you don't see that you're attached to. And that's so close to us oftentimes, we really don't see it. So just like yesterday, I was talking about rebirth, how someone in an Indian society might think of someone in Western society, you think consciousness is the body? You really think that? And someone in Western culture would think, you think consciousness gets reborn? You must be crazy. So there's two cultural perspectives. Of course, we're scientific. So then there's the kinseek too. Sometimes you don't even see that. It's so close and so close to us. So I was just thinking about humor. How, like in Thailand, I remember falling down in the rainy season. It could be very slippery because the monsoon was truly torrential. And we'd be barefoot going on forest paths to the villages for alms round. And once I fell in the mud, and everyone laughed. I said, and then later on I saw someone, a Thai monk, fall, and he laughed, the one on the ground. And I realized they weren't laughing at me, they were just laughing at life. Anyway, they helped me up and brushed me off, and someone, you know. So it was like my culture perception is, you should feel sorry for me. But they weren't cruel, it's just that was their way of laughter. Our one really extreme one, one of the monks, you know what a gecko is? Gecko is a large lizard with quite a large head. And they get around on the walls and go, gecko, that kind of sound. And one of the monks said, do geckos bite? And the Thai monk said, oh, they don't bite. So this Western monk grabs a gecko, and the gecko goes, ah, on his thumb, blood spurting out, and the Thais are all laughing. You believe that? Now, to us, that sounds really cruel, right? And they helped him out and bound. But, you know, it was a different take on humor. And like, say, in Amaravati, I think we have 20 nationalities. German humor is not the same as British humor. it's very, very different. And so we can, you know, we can be reactive. We can have views about how life should be. Things about how a man should be, how a woman should be, how, you know, a parent should be. I read a lovely piece in, everyone read Arctic Dreams by Barry Lopez? Oh, exquisite writing. And it's a lovely reflection on things, all things Arctic. And he talked about the traditional hunting Inuit cultures, this traditional, which isn't much of that left. And he said that when a child had a disappointment, and I don't know how you could do this, but the mother would encourage the child to laugh to get past the disappointment. So rather than using distraction, the parents used laughter. And they just kept training the kids that way, so that when something disappointing happens, you go to laughter. And then he cites an example of a hunter, and this is summertime, he's got his tent, he's got all his hunting gear, he's got his little Primus stove, and you know, that's all he's got. He's got this hunting gear, and it all burns down. Now that would be like your hard drive going, right? 10 times over, I suppose, because you couldn't get a new one. So, fairly major disaster. The way the hunter handles it, he lasts for 3 days. He lasts. And then he's welcomed into the community, but he's not aggressive. He's not angry. You know, he's not going, "Yeah, definitely burn down." He's actually released it all through laughter, and the small little community can welcome him in again and somehow help him replenish, and he can get back into it. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. That's really interesting. So we're conditioned culturally, and that the sense of I that comes up around that quite often is just kind of hidden. But yet, it is a strong sense of I. So when we react to something in a strong, strong way, it might be wrong what we're seeing and we're reacting, which is okay. But just that kind of assumption that about our perceptions and how we interpret life, how life should be, how men and women should be, how society should live together. I get a lot of that as a monk. You know, lay people project on how monasticism should be. And I get people coming with opinions about how monasticism should be. And I say, how long have you been a monk? You know, I'm not going to give you any advice about marriage. Right? Leave me alone. And so we'll have strong opinions about things like that. It's not wrong to have them, but to kind of see that that's one of the kind of attachments where a sense of self is created in ways which are oftentimes very hard to see. So monasticism is very hierarchical, and we had someone from a kind of Amish background. What was that? Not Mormon Amish, what was it, the third one? You know who I mean. A Mennonite background. And this person found the hierarchy very difficult. It's a benign hierarchy, you know, we care for each other, and he knew it. It was interesting, he knew it. But his aversion to it was so strong he had to leave. And he knew it himself, you know, he couldn't see it, but it was so kind of in his guts and he kind of respected me and respected everyone, but when it came to that, he just could not do it. It was so kind of deeply embedded in him, a kind of egalitarian idea. So how should life be? Well, it should be moral. And then how people organize the societies, it depends on a lot of things. So when we are, you know, when we do react in certain ways like that, like Amaravati, seeing all these different cultures getting together, it's very, very interesting. But what binds us as a community is a Vinaya, which is certainly comes from Indian culture, but it's based on very, very good principles, very lovely principles, so we learn it that way. Let me answer some of these questions. Take on how we laugh. You just say, well, laughter is laughter, but actually, there's a lot of conditioning around it. Okay, this morning we read the 10 subjects for frequent recollection. Those were two monastics. And we're asked, do I delight in solitude or not? What is the right answer? Or for a monastic, it would be, yes, I do delight in solitude, because the solitude part of our life is where we do a lot of studying, a lot of samatha practice or whatever. But in Asian society, like for Westerners, solitude actually comes more easily probably than for some of the Thai monks, because they're a group society. Indians are a group society. And so the tendency is to want to be with the family, with the group, with that identity. And so solitude might be a bit more difficult. For us, it's actually probably more easy. For us, it's more like, do I really want to see my fellow brothers? Not really, I just want the breakfast. So for us, there's quite often a different issue, is that being with each other is quite often more difficult than actually the solitude part. The solitude part is sometimes easier. It depends. So in our monastery, we try to have both. We have times of communal gathering and times of solitude. We have a winter retreat coming, so we get a lot of solitude then, which is really interesting. And then sometimes monks like Ajahn Sona just did a solitary retreat for a year. We sat sometimes. You have been a monastic for circa 40 years. You have many monastics and meditators. In that time, how many, in your opinion, have attained Nibbana? Or to put it another way, what are the chances for us? No, I think you just go to the pub. Forget it, right? That's the kind of question that we're not really at. By our ethos, we're asked to not go there, because then it misses the point of the teaching, because it's not, it would be a kind of unprofitable question. Like, so I think the profitable question is the path worthwhile, rather than am I getting the birthday cake out of this? And to me, it's worthwhile. To me, it's good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. And the trouble with the very definition of Nibbana, you'll get different variants on, you know, what epiphany is, or so on and so forth. So I think perhaps a better question, does it work day to day? Does it make life more meaningful? Does it work on a micro level rather than a macro level? Could you live without it? Could you live without Dhamma? Is meditation just helpful in providing stability to your life that then enhances your life? I think those are kind of more profitable questions. And then the realization of Nibbana, well, you'll get different interpretations of that. And who am I to say what other monks have attained or people have attained? And I'm not copping out on the question. I just think it's like Ajahn Chah would be asked, are you enlightened? And he said, like that thing I read, oh, I don't know. Am I enlightened? He wouldn't go there. And people would ask him, are others enlightened? So he just wouldn't go there. And so that's been quite strong in my upbringing. Quite strong. So I don't want to cop out on the question, but I think it's more profitable to say, is it like, could I live without this? What if I didn't have the Dhamma? What if I didn't have a practice? How would it be? For me, it's just invaluable. It's invaluable. Whatever level I can realize. So, a non-answer. Okay, Ajahn, you spoke about some preliminaries to sitting meditation practice. So I suggested bringing up faith, Namo Tassa. I suggested the Metta Sutta. Then the kind of reviewing the object of meditation, making a clear intention to pick up the object of meditation. So the question then, do you have any suggestions for us immediately following a sitting period? For example, review. Well, Ajahn Chah would say, if your meditation makes you peaceful, accept it. If your meditation doesn't make you peaceful, accept it. So there is something about the meditative life which sometimes you don't understand what you're going through. You know, you have some really restless period in your meditation, and all you can do is just hang in there, and you hang in and you hang in. And then sometime later you're really peaceful and you don't connect the two. You know, how can I get that peace back? And you don't realize that actually, no, you develop some strength and perseverance and so on during those difficult ones, and you thought it was a piece of garbage, right? But actually, in that time, you're developing certain strengths like perseverance, persistence, and so on. And sometimes that kind of result is hidden. We don't really see that. But having said that, you do acquire skill, don't you? You begin to, you know, I see what my body's doing now. So you develop a I think, a body sensitivity, don't you? Your practice is informed by body awareness. To me, that seems to be something that I review probably as I meditate, not explicitly, but implicitly. I'm always aware of the body. So you just, yeah, you get, you, once you get a sense of it, it's like, how portable is that practice now too? Like, when I get off the cushion, do I enter into my communal life in a way which is more compassionate and more centered? Or am I becoming more selfish? That's a very common one to look at, because sometimes one can get very refined states of mind and then one begins to resent, say in the monastery or the other, contact with the other monks. They're bothering me. And that is an attachment to refinement, where I think when the heart's really compassionate and open, the capacity to be aware and to adapt and to respond is actually much more, much better and much stronger. And the sense of gratitude and generosity is more strong. So you want to help your brothers, and you want to serve the monastery because it does work. So attachment to refinement can be a dangerous one. But people who like to analyze things, I kind of like to review, I guess, and do that. I don't do that. I'm more intuitive, I think. I don't kind of go back and review and analyze. I'm much more in the, you know, like present moment, what's happening, like that. But you do develop a methodology, intuitively or whatever, and you develop a way where you intuitively know what's going on with your body, what kind of meditation object to pick up. But I'm not very clinical that way. So I know, like, when the sitting ends, I don't just move on the bell. It's not, okay, it's the way it is now. Yeah. So I try to go out of that period in a mindful way rather than, oh, wow, man, that was a tough one. I mean, I do that sometimes, too. But that, you know, I think the movements I hear sometimes is whoa, I survived that. Good on you, you survived it. But to actually, when the bell rings, there's a feel of that sense of relief. Ah, it's over. It feels quite a relaxed state of mind. Might as well enjoy it for 2 seconds. What are the best ways to pass our merits to our deceased parents? So this idea of punya is merit. And so this is a kind of Buddhist idea that the good works I can do can benefit my loved ones. And there's a difficulty with that idea, because what do you do with, I am the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, abide supported by my karma? So what's the deal, right? Can I get a bit of yours? and it is, it's a conflict. It's a conflict in the philosophy. And I've asked scholars who have a broad knowledge of the suttas, and they say, well, there apparently is a state of consciousness where the being is kind of in a bardo realm, and the being can feel and know what's going on, and that being, if something is done for that being, and the merit and the goodness is that, well, for this being, may this offering be a benefit. The being feels that, knows that, hears that. That brings up joy, and that good karma of their merit then moves them on in their journey. And that's the only explanation I've heard which makes kind of sense to me. So that's the logic of it. But the emotional part of it, I just do it. So there's my logical mind, you know, which gets that. But every year, I, like, on the 8th of December, my mom's birthday is on the 8th of December, and she died on the 22nd of March, I always organize a big meal. I don't cook it. I got friends. And we have a party for Mom. So this year, on the 7th of December, it'll be a Sunday. And I just send emails to people who knew my mom, and I asked the ladies to bring some strudel or something that Mom liked. And I just do it for her. And that feels great. And that feels great. And then I try not to, think about it too much, philosophize about it too much. And I do the chanting, sharing of blessings, and say, may this deed be of merit to my mom, and so on and so forth. So I just do it, because it's a lovely cultural thing to do. And then if someone argues or asks me about it, then I go to that story. But I don't know. I don't really know how consciousness works. So there's some parts of my faith which are based on faith, and there's the logical mind. So the idea then is to just do a deliberate activity and to think of one's loved one, parent or whatever, and say, may this activity be a benefit to my mom. Quite simple. And the traditionalists who, in Buddhist countries, people will offer a meal to the Sangha on the occasion either of the person's birthday or the day they passed away. Some people will go to like a food distribution center, like Sally Ann's, and just that day then go and like dedicate a meal to mom or just see someone panhandling on the street and just, give 10 panhandlers some money or something like that. It's simple things. So it's a lovely. We don't have, I don't think we have cultural rituals. In secular society, you don't have those kind of cultural rituals. That's one of the things I learned in Thailand, where they have these beautiful ways of expressing gratitude and a sense of affection and that in a very... So in Thailand, say, like on a person's birthday, they'll bring a meal to the monastery. Rather than have a party themselves, they'll bring it to the monastery. Or like an alms round in Bangkok, in the morning at 6 o'clock in Bangkok, all the monks are out on the streets, and lay people in the marketplace will offer them food. And every now and then, when I'm in Bangkok, a lay person will pull up in a car. It'd usually be a wealthy person, and they'll open the boot of their car, and they'll have prepared 20 offerings for 20 monks, and it'd be their birthday. So they would have worked all evening, all night before, and they'll have rice and curry and fruit and flowers and things like that. And as soon as they see a monk, and they'll put all the stuff in the bowl, and then after 20 monks, they'll go to work. Now, it's quite joyous, but a kind of joyous thing to do. Someone in the monastery, they hadn't really done anything when their mother died, I think. So we made a big dana for the person's mom. And she was crying tears of joy. It really, brought out some very good things in her. So... We are very grateful for your teachings and for having Tisranata learn and practice. There are people, especially young people, who did not have the conditions or who are not exposed to the path. For example, if a child is growing up in a family poor and not having a faith, he or she will tend also to perpetuate the states of ignorance. Would you say that is their karma? Yeah, in Buddhism it would be. It's not it's not crime or punishment. It's causally related. But the exact nature of that, I don't know. I don't know how it is. But that certainly would be a Buddhist viewpoint. Then there is the cases of our surroundings, partner, children, relatives who do not believe, and on what I am practicing or only half believe. Should I go do more persuasion and convincing? Be careful. If you don't have the authority, people can misuse your sincerity. You really, you need permission, don't you? You need either permission or authority to offer reflection. So the best way to offer reflection is to listen first and then see where the person's at, and then to elicit from them their suffering, and then to talk about their suffering, and then you have Buddhism. But don't do it, you know, in the first level, kind of just see where they're at. Or just say that this is their karma, that they do not see the needs to practice yet, and perhaps in their next and later life they will. No, I mean, if you can offer reflection, but quite often people just aren't interested. Quite often you find, like sometimes with monks, that their parents won't listen to them, but they'll listen to another monk. You know, like a father just can't take his son telling him Dharma. You know, but another monk will. I found that when I came in 77, when I came with Ajahn Anando, we went to Buffalo and Toronto. His folks were in Buffalo, mine were in Toronto. And his folks would listen to me, but not to him. And my folks would listen to him, but not to me. Yeah, so the whole thing of karma is I think the trouble with that is that we take it, and Westerners, culturally, as a kind of crime and punishment thing. You're being punished. So for us, it's repugnant, oftentimes. Not necessarily, but I know sometimes those are the feelings that come from me. Whereas in Thailand, where they say it's cause and effect, and then that answers the question: you know, what happens? Why do good people get bad things, and why do bad people get good things? You know, why did Stalin die in bed? He must have been he was totally paranoid. He had that, and why did Pol Pot? So you get very difficult philosophical questions, and you can't really go there. But as a tool, you know, as a tool for your own life, it can be very skillful to say, how do you bring up in your own mind a sense of acceptance of your difficulties? How do you do that? In Islam, they say it's Allah is testing me or something, and Christianity would maybe say it's God's mystery. And for a believing person in those faiths, that works for them. For me, it doesn't work. So, so I have some really kind of conflict with someone in the monastery for, you know, a couple of years and just can't understand them. And then I say, well, somehow it's my karma. I've got to learn from this. That's quite helpful. Where it can be unhelpful is with, you know, I see a crippled person. I say, it's their karma. It's dismissive. It lacks compassion. So it can be misused, too. Well, it's their karma. They're crippled. So what? You know, I'm not going to help them to the toilet. Which you could see that might be misused that way. So always Buddhism has a sense of this universal compassion. Whatever your karma is, you know, if I can help you, I'm going to try to help you, rather than a kind of passive, well, it's your problem, mate. I'm okay. So these are beliefs that we have, we don't know. So my sense of it is, how do you use a belief structure to liberate the mind rather than hold on to it? So again, it comes back to a perception rather than a belief. If I have some social or physical difficulty and I use the perception of karma, oh, this is a result of karma, right? That's different than a kind of belief in karma, isn't it? See what I mean? I keep coming back to that, don't I? You know, that kind of way of making it palatable. But if it's like crime and punishment, you can really freak out with that. Oh, gosh, I did something wrong. A woman came to Ajahn Sumedho. She had an abortion 10 years before. She said, what's going to be my karma? I had an abortion. Ajahn says, well, the karma is what you're experiencing now. That's all he could say. She did something. This was the result. The fear she had or whatever. Rather than, thou shalt, you know, you're going to go to some hell realm, whatever it is. So that's a kind of pragmatic way, I think, of approaching that. Like the tsunami. How many people died in that thing? Was it 100,000 or some massive amount of people in Thailand, Sri Lanka? Now, is that like karma? All of a sudden, everyone gets swamped? In Asia, they'd say maybe, yeah. I just can't compute that myself all at once. It's just too big for me. But I don't have to. I don't have to figure that out because it's not a good question. It's not a skillful question in those terms. Why did that happen? Don't know. Beats me. So how do I use like ideas of karma skillfully to bring my sense to myself to a sense of openness and compassion and yet equanimity too? And then that seems to me the useful way of that. So in terms of if you can help a person and show them ways of being mindful, great. But I was talking to someone just recently where they were, sometimes we begin to proselytize our family. And what's more boring than that? And I did that. I don't know about you. When I got into Buddhism, like I was a real born-again Buddhist. And, you know, the letters I sent my parents are embarrassing. Like they're a bunch of idiots, right? Refugees, survived the war, hardworking, right? Kind of made it again in Canada, and here's this young guy, convert. This thing goes embarrassing. And that's, of course, a kind of lack of sensitivity, lack of listening. So I always find, first of all, if I listen to someone, I can see if they're interested in reflection. If they're not, then okay, fair enough, rather than just kind of giving advice. But yeah, some people don't have a reflective mind. They're not interested. They're just not going there, so fair enough. Fair enough. That's more time comments. Oh. Is Buddhism a path to non-duality? So non-duality is used in various ways. We would say it's a path to liberation. And that liberation comes about through the cessation of craving. That would be the canonical way of putting it. And part of that path would be to identify ego structures and how they create suffering. So the language around non-duality in, say, Advaita Vedanta is very similar to the language that Buddhism uses. But Buddhism is a gradual path. Something like Advaita is, they say, it's the kind of sudden path. And Buddhism lays out a moral philosophy or a moral structure that you can reflect on. It lays out social conventions. It describes methods of meditation. It describes, you know, it has an analysis of mind, analysis of the of psychology. So the Buddha called it a gradual path. And quite often the non-dual teachings would refute that, say, you know, the very idea of gradualism is an idea of self, that I am someone who has to become enlightened. I'm someone who wants to become enlightened already is delusion, because there's no one to become enlightened. It's not self. The Buddhist answer to that is, that's all very well and good, but still, what do you do about your moral life? And how do you train your mind to stay in the moment? So the assumption sometimes that the Advaita or non-dual teachings make is that Buddhist meditation, that when it's a kind of critique of Buddhism, when it comes at it that way, they tend to think that all effort is ego-based, it's future-based, but it needn't be. It can be tainted by that. So the two come together in some of the, like Prajnaparamita Sutta, those kinds of things. And I think Advaita is a very, like non-dual teachings, a very good adjunct to Buddhism, because Buddhism tends to talk about letting go of the khandhas, and Advaita talks about liberation from the khandhas. And I think they're, for those of you who have read the Ramana Maharshi or different Advaita teachers, Advaita means non-dual. Advaita Vedanta is non-dual, and you'll find some very good teachers now, contemporary. And so I like that. I find that really really helpful. I found some of the Advaita teachers very helpful for me, but they didn't offer a path for me. So I'm grateful for that. Buddhism offered me a fuller path. So the question again is, is Buddhism a path to non-duality? You know, I'd say, well, I think that would be kind of maybe yes and no. I think it'd be shortchanging the Buddhist teaching. And then again, we might get into differences about what non-duality might be. But it's a relevant teaching. Teachings on non-duality. So I've read my most influential non-Buddhist teacher is a teacher called Jean Klein. And then early on I read Ramana Maharshi and Srinivasagadatta. They're very influential. And what I found is that because I have a good grounding in Four Noble Truths, I can see in the language of someone like Jean Klein, who to me seemed already very refined, very, very refined mind already, where, you know, questions of ethics weren't even there. So already there, to me, this was a very kind of developed being, and he just needed a little bit more for his, I think he's enlightened, I don't know. When I read a teacher like that, because I've got a good grounding in Buddhism, I can see, oh yeah, that's what he's pointing to in terms of right effort. So when he talks about effort and how he describes it, that helps me understand right effort in Buddhism. It's very, you know, it's another angle. Or even Rumi. You know, I read Rumi, and his kind of drunken enlightenment is great, isn't it? This sort of, it almost sounds erotic, doesn't it? His love affair with the divine. And so I look at that literally and think, where is he at? But then I step back and I say, well, so what would that be in terms of what I understand? So when I use my Buddhist ideas not as dogma or as belief, but as reflection, then I find I read Merton, not so much anymore, but I've read Merton and Thomas Merton and things like that. Then they help me question my own. And sometimes, but like Thomas Merton, I didn't understand half of what he wrote or a quarter of what he wrote, but it was still kind of stimulating for my own path. So that's what I find, that if you don't have a core teaching, I think if you don't have a core teaching, and you're just very eclectic, I think you can just stay inspired, but not necessarily edified. You know, edification is when I take a teaching and it really, like really, I have to go into, well, what do I believe? And what do I know? And what do I understand? And now this thing is coming at me. Where does that fit? Now, if I don't have a core philosophy and I haven't thought it through quite clearly, wrote it out maybe, contemplated it, then I can just feel inspired by, you know, a poem. Ah, that's great. And then, you know, Thomas Merton, ah, that's really neat. And so just kind of not take their reflections more deeply. You know Karen Armstrong, the great scholar who wrote, what, History of God? And if you've read her biography, she's interesting because she comes out of the, what was she, a Carmelite nun? So she was a nun for 7 years and it absolutely did not work for her, totally did not work for her. She goes to Oxford and she wants to write a critique of God. And she, you know, this is, you know, she's going to lambast God. And she gets into the scriptorium, and because she is a contemplative, reflective scholar, from what I could read of her biography, she gets into the text, and because she's not a believer, she's reflective, her mind goes to where the writer is. And she realizes, you know, she has these epiphanies from reading these texts. And it's kind of, I just, you know, talking about it, I get kind of jingly. very inspiring. And I never understood a scholar before. I really understood it from her. I understood what a scholar is doing. But she's getting right into those texts in a way, from the language, to what this mystic is talking about. And then she comes out of it, and she writes this brilliant book, History of God. Now that kind of capacity to really go into something and pick up all the ideas and become imbued with it is I think we have to do it at least once. And that's what the Four Noble Truths are about, or taking on a Buddhist idea where you do it with one philosophy at least once. You really go deeply into it and you get a feeling, well, you know, you have dependent origination, you have Four Noble Truths, you have three characteristics, you have Samma Samadhi. What is this all about? And I went through that difficulty of trying to get my head around this, you know, all these different teachings. And finally, when I figured out they're all pointing to one thing, and they're pointing in different ways, and that was really helpful. And then from then on, I had a body of like an intellectual structure, which then I could take other things and reflect on them, not just try to Buddhicize them, because I can do that. I can take Christianity and Buddhicize it really well. But it's not Christianity. But then I can take something like Merton and say, so what's he talking about? So I have a way of reflection rather than believing or disbelieving. And that tends to deepen my practice. Or psychology, or when I hear things like, what was it? Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, is that called?
Yep. Yeah.
And I thought, that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. So having a structure is very helpful.